So sometimes you'll sit on a board or in a management team, and because the team is so large and accountability is so diffused, then you might get people that sort of sit back and say, well, that's not really my remit. I don't want to step on someone else's toes. That's their remit. And that sort of mentality doesn't really exist with really good founder-led companies, because they instill a culture that we are working as a team to achieve an outcome.
Welcome to The Greener Way. I'm your host, Rosemary Petrus, Senior Journalist at FS Sustainability. We are recording on Gadigal land and we pay our respects to traditional custodians of country and elders past, present and emerging. Today, we are going to talk about founder-led companies, which can produce high returns but can also be high risk for investors. Lawrence Lamb joins us on the podcast today. He's the Managing Director and Founder of Luminary Investment Management and the author of The Founder Effect, a book that provides a framework to identify and invest in high-performing founder-led companies. Welcome to the show, Lawrence.
Thank you, Rose. Thanks for having me.
So to start off with, to set the scene, tell us about your book and the process that went into researching and writing it.
Yeah, sure. The book itself was a two-year process to write, but it's a real culmination of over 20 years of experience in financial markets. I've spent time working for government. I've spent time working at consultancies. And most of my career is actually in investment banking before I launched my funds management business, Luminary Investment Management. And through that journey, seeing lots of companies from different lenses, from as a federal regulator, and then as someone providing advice, and then finally as someone investing in these companies, I spotted companies that were run very well. They were very under the radar. They weren't looking for limelight. And they had this special quality about them where they behaved very differently to others. And when I say behave, it actually shows up in financial performance. It shows up in their financial statements as to their way of thinking. I first came across one of these companies early on in my career. And what struck me was that this company was super successful, had the family name part of their logo. They were a winemaker in rural Australia. And they were embarking on this international expansion, but they didn't really rely on outside equity or debt. They were quite conservative in using their own cash flows. And this was pre-GFC days, which was very rare to see, because everyone was saying, you've got a lazy balance sheet, you need to do it, you need to borrow, you need to gear up. And instead, they, as a result, held up really well during the GFC. Mm-hmm. Then I started spotting more and more of these companies. They're quite rare in general, but I started having an eye for them to the point where I thought, well, I can work backwards to see, though I can predict success based on these traits that you can observe. And so the question the book answers is, what makes exceptional management teams? In particular, those teams that can grow companies over very long periods of time. And I answer that in a framework, and importantly, provide a objective framework, a scientific approach to something that's generally quite qualitative. When you mm-hmm. say, okay, how good is the team? Well, it's very subjective. It's very qualitative. Most people will say, oh, you look at, you interview them, you do surveys, you look at their body language. But executives are well primed for dealing with investors and very good at corporate spin. So it's about cutting through that. And that's what mm-hmm. this provides.
So you mentioned there that founder-led companies can be more effective at navigating economic crises. What other benefits are there to investing in them?
If I take a step back, it's all comes down to a level of psychological ownership. And you want to look at companies, you want to have in your management team a strong sense of that they own the business. And that can manifest in several ways. For example, if you look at someone like a Jack Gance from Chemist Warehouse, who I interviewed for the book, he shares details as to how he thinks about business. He doesn't see it as a numbers-to-numbers game, as he puts it. It's a people-to-people game. So he mm-hmm. knows from his suppliers, not just at the top level, he knows down the line to actual personnel within the counterparts' companies. he looks at weekly sales reports of every single store. Even as chair, CEO, and I think he's taken a bit of a step back since the listing, that attention to detail is one way it can manifest. The other way I like to describe is a general sense of adaptive paranoia. A lot of these founders have a sense of, hey, this could be taken away at any minute. And therefore, for me, I really need to think long-term, to think, how will I evolve to the next level before it catches me off guard? That level of paranoia certainly takes a personal cost, but from a business perspective, from an investor's perspective, it's a good thing to have. You don't want complacent management teams. And then the obvious one is just, you know, put simply, skin in the game. Most people understand that with founders, they have a strong ownership component. They are involved in the business day to day, and they obviously care about leaving a legacy for generations to come.
And what kind of challenges or obstacles may come up when you're looking at investing in founder-led companies, particularly from a governance perspective?
Yeah, I think the textbook approach is to say, well, you want that separation between board management. You want that independence. And certainly a bit of that helps. But if it's too much, then you just end up with a bureaucratic organization where you're not aligned. I spend a fair bit of time in the book unpacking alignment and what it means for such a subjective topic of alignment. What does it mean? It's interesting where if teams aren't aligned, you get cognitive bias is creeping in. So there's two that I mentioned by way of example. I've got more in the book. A diffusion of accountability. So sometimes you'll sit on a board or in a management team, and because the team is so large and accountability is so diffused, then you might get people that sort of sit back and say, well, that's not really my remit. I don't want to step on someone else's toes. That's their remit. And that sort of mentality doesn't really exist with really good founder-led companies, because they instill a culture that we are working as a team to achieve an outcome, and I go above and beyond. So in some sense, you prefer that very strong alignment between owners, management, and the board. You want all of them, ideally, as closely aligned as possible, with a touch of independence thrown in, but not too much. Obviously, you'll get challenges with a lot of arguments against founders are saying, well, they take control and they can't let go. That's not so much of an issue of limiting a founder's contribution, but it's more the challenge of, how do I scale a business and replicate the culture beyond just the founder? And there are objective ways you can see this happening in companies. A prime example is what Graham Turner did at Flight Centre when he scaled from 3 shops into a multinational business that's in the US in multiple business lines. His approach is a prehistoric one. He believes in capping the number of people within a certain hierarchy so that it creates more of a hub and spoke model rather than a typical pyramid triangle approach where that's how most corporates grow. And then they restructure every few years, losing a lot of that momentum. So those are the typical challenges, but it's not so much insurmountable.
Of course, there are some instances where founder-led companies have experienced scandals. For example, the Uber co-founder Travis Kalanick faced controversies around the toxic workplace culture and aggressive business practices. And WeWork co-founder Adam Neumann was forced to step down as CEO due to concerns about his leadership style. So from a governance perspective, how can these kind of scandals and management risks be avoided or managed?
Yeah, a lot of these risks come from not so much bad actors, but more unchecked incentives and unchecked egos, I would say. You know, there's no secret that with this business success that a lot of founders have, their ego also grows in lockstep. And if it's unchecked, that's where it becomes an issue. I write in the book about Wells Fargo. It's not a founder-led company, but for such a massive national bank, they had such a large scandal of outright fraud within multiple departments.
Mm-hmm.
And how that happens is effectively group cognitive biases. And what I explore in the book is, okay, as an outsider, as an investor, what are the things I can look at in particular in terms of incentives and motivation with organizational structure and board structures that I can observe objectively that might give me a sense that, hey, this organization could be susceptible to these types of risks, or they're more likely to run into these problems where incentives and egos are unchecked, or people are just given too much free rein. There's obvious examples in Australia as well, not just with founders, but you look at, say, AMP and Woolworths with the sexual harassment scandals that have happened there. You know, it happens everywhere. It's I wouldn't say it's a particular thing down to bad actors. It's more having structures and observing what is being done to control those and mitigate those risks.
And what kind of green flags should investors be looking for that might indicate good governance, on the other hand?
I think there has to be, well, in the book, I explore really three things in detail. I look at the ability to make bold decisions. I look at psychological ownership. And I look at the ability for management teams to be influential, both internally with their own team, but also externally with shareholders, customers, and the media. These three topics seem like they're very subjective, but actually when you drill down into it, you can observe these facts. A quick example is Lego. They are one of the largest privately owned companies in the world. But you wouldn't know that in the early 2000s, they actually went through significant issues to the point where they were very close to being bankrupt. And if they weren't private, as the CEO said at the time, they probably would have been bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
They have since turned that business around magnificently. And it requires a very strong leadership that can make those really tough decisions. They went back to the drawing board entirely. They streamlined all of their internal processes first in terms of their infrastructure. So we're talking about the way they deal with customers, their software and systems and people had to be reorganized fully before they could even achieve what they've achieved now. The second thing was they reached into tapping into what are we about as a company? Are we about physical play, or are we about digital play with digital devices that kids, which they now compete with for video games and music and all the other forms of entertainment that kids have today? Well, they said, no, we're about physical play. We're going to lean into that and we're going to do more of that, but incorporate some elements of digital into our ecosystem. So, for example, they have programming for Lego blocks where you can train your programming skills for kids.
Oh, wow.
Those are the types of initiatives that they innovated. And those are the signs for me of good governance, is that you can have the ability to set up well to make those tough, hard decisions that take years to pay off.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. Where can people find your book?
It's available as an ebook, paperback, audiobook coming shortly in all good bookstores. And I have a quarterly newsletter that I publish. You can sign up at lawrencelam.org.
Until next time, I'm Rosemary Petrus, and thank you for listening to The Green Away.
The Green Away podcast is a product of FS Sustainability, a show about people, the planet, and investing in our collective future. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. The Green Away podcast gives listeners access to information and educational content provided by discussing numerous financial sustainable options and our featured guests. It is not intended as a substitute for professional, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of The Greener Way are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Before making any financial decisions, you should read the product disclosure statement, and if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the FS Sustainability website, fssustainability.com.au.